Hello, everybody, and welcome to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation. Okay, welcome back to Take One. Today, we have a very special episode for all of you guys. As you know, starting last week, I've been covering the 42nd edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival. I was able to cover the 42nd edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival as a member of the press, which I am extremely thankful to everyone at VIF, everyone at MPMG Marketing Group, everyone at the NFB, everyone who basically helped me get interviews, get screeners, and, you know, who helped this experience become one of the best of my life. So last week, for those of you who remember, for those of you who were here, last week I played an interview that I did with Karsten Wall, a documentarian who recently made a documentary about geese, a documentary called Modern Goose. If you missed that interview, I would highly advise you to check out the Take One social media, maybe on Instagram, maybe the Take One website, on the CITR website, and there you will be able to find the episodes that I've done for Take One in podcast form, and you'll be able to listen to the interview that I did with Karsten Wall. That said, today it is time we keep going on my VIF coverage, and today I have a very special episode for all of you guys because I will be playing an interview that I did with the one and only Sam Green. For those of you who don't know, Sam Green is a documentary filmmaker who was nominated for Best Documentary at the Oscars for a documentary that he did in the early 2000s. I will talk about all of this in the interview that I'm about to play. But most recently, he has been focused on doing live documentaries. So, without further ado, here is my interview with the one and only Sam Green. And here it is. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Take One. Today, I am joined by Sam Green, a New York-based documentary filmmaker who directed The Weather Underground, which was nominated for Best Documentary Feature Film at the Academy Awards. That said, he is best known for pushing the boundaries of documentary filmmaking by creating in-person theatrical experiences known as live documentaries. His most recent live documentary, 32 Sounds, will be performed on the 5th of October at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Sam, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Hell yeah. And the first thing I'll say is congratulations. I absolutely loved 32 Sounds. I honestly feel that calling 32 Sounds a documentary feels like a disservice to the sensory experience that it actually is. I loved it. I have never watched a film that engages with my sense of hearing like this one does. I've never watched a movie that is this interactive. You know, I've never seen a film that has asked me to close my eyes, shout, and break into dance in the middle of the film. But it is also a very profound and moving experience. So once again, congratulations.
Thank you for saying all that. And I'm happy that the movie did something to you.
Oh, it did many things to me. But okay, let's jump right into the first question, which is, you know, ever since I heard about you and about your work, I've been fascinated by this idea of live documentaries. And that brings me to my first question, which is, what is a live documentary?
The question I've struggled with for the past 10 years. It's my pithy answer to that is it's having an event where I narrate in person on a stage, a band or musicians do the soundtrack live, and the film screens. So it's all the elements of a movie. It just happens live, which sometimes people are still like, what? You know, and I have to sort of explain in more detail. But your audience, I think, is very smart, and that's enough. I hope.
Hell yeah. Yeah, okay. That's perfect. Now, the second question is, what inspired you to start making these live documentaries?
It's a good question, and it's a long story, which I'll make short, but I was editing a movie, and it was a kind of experimental movie about utopia, and I was very stuck with it. I showed people a rough cut, you know, when you're sort of half done and you're editing, and everybody said, this makes no sense. Like, I don't understand this movie at all, and I was completely crestfallen and didn't know what to do. And in that moment, somebody wrote me and said, hey, would you give a talk about your film project? And I said, sure, I'll show some pieces of video and I'll talk and I'll, it sounds really boring. So I'll have a friend do live music. So it's like a fancy lecture. And the person said, sure. So I did that. I talked about the project and showed clips and he made live music and it really worked. It was everything I wanted the film to do. And I kind of filed that away. And then a film festival said, hey, would you come do that talk at our film festival? And I said, sure. And I made it even fancier. And then it worked again, just like I wanted the movie to. And so then I sort of thought, well, I've never heard of this form, but I am a big believer in the material dictates the form, and or should. And so I thought, well, you know, I've never heard of a live documentary, but I'll try it. And I somehow submitted it to Sundance and they showed it. And so I thought, this is cool. I'll do one show and, you know, go back to making movies. But after that, all over the world, people said, will you come do your live documentary? And I had so much fun. I've never been in a band. By that point, I had three musicians and I've never been in a band, but it was really fun. We traveled around. It was like being in a band. And also, it was right around the time when people started to watch movies on their computers at home while checking email, you know, which I do, but I just thought this is a terrible way to experience cinema, especially a movie about utopia, which was what that movie was about. You know, utopia is always about a collective experience, and you're telling me people are going to be at home checking email watching this? It's like not good. So this live form seemed to fit, and after that, I just really liked the form. It became interesting to me. There's so much potential. There's such powerful tools to have a huge image and big music and people turn off their phones. You really got them. You know, it's like cinema at its most powerful. So I really just, I've kept coming back to it. I think I've made four or five of these because I just like the potential of the form a lot and figuring out how to use it to its fullest.
Oh yeah. Well, I love them, so definitely keep them coming. But I think I know the answer to my next questions, but I'll ask it just in case. And my next question is, will your live documentaries ever become available through streaming services, physical media, or video on demand? And if the answer is no, which I suspect, why is that the case?
That's a great question. And until now, I said no, just because there was something about, so I did a live documentary that actually screened in Vancouver about 7 years ago about a guy named Buckminster Fuller. And he was like an inventor and futurist. And I did that with a band called Yola Tango. It was an indie band and lots of people love that band. And one of the things I realized with that is like when they walk into the hall, the venue, when they come out on stage, you can feel there's like a gasp in the audience. People love bands. People love bands way more than they ever love filmmakers. You know? So it became interesting to me. That piece worked in large part because they were there in the room. If they're just making the score, it's a different experience. You're just, it's a normal movie with a, you know, you don't get too excited if Johnny Greenwood, I mean, I love him. That's not a good example. But if Yola Tango does the score for a movie, it's cool. But if they're in the room with you, it's super cool. So I made a film about the Kronos Quartet and they play the soundtrack. Same thing. But this new movie, 32 Sounds, I've actually also made as a regular movie. And sometimes it shows as a regular movie in a movie theater. I'm not there and it works. It's the first time I made something that works in both arenas. So that one is a regular movie and eventually will be on iTunes and all that. So.
Hell yeah. I'm happy to hear that. Lovely. Yeah. I'm so excited because, you know, I've been telling my family and friends like, hey, I just watched this incredible live documentary and it's a shame because I don't know if you'll ever be able to watch it. But if you
make them go to the show, at least in Vancouver.
For sure. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be a bit difficult considering that most of my family lives in Colombia, but I'll try.
All right. Well, let's just send them the link.
Hell yeah. You know, down the line when it's in iTunes, I'll tell them to buy it. But anyways, you know, that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, as we've been saying, your most recent live documentary is called 32 Sounds.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about 32 Sounds? You know, what is this project and what makes it so special?
32 Sounds is, I mean, it's hard to answer that question, but I mean, the short answer is it's a documentary all about sound. and sort of the mysterious and powerful nature of sound, how sound can bring us back in time to other people and places, can remind us of things, can move us in odd ways. So I'm totally intrigued with sound and how it works. And so I really was inspired to make the movie for that reason. Sound is endlessly fascinating to me. So that's sort of a description, but it uses, you know, sound is so vast. You could make 8 million movies. You could make a 10-hour movie about sound. So with this movie, I use this sort of structuring device, which is 32 different sounds. It's sort of essay about sound builds around 32 specific recordings of things. And it's an eclectic mix, ranging from the foghorns of San Francisco to the sound of a whoopee cushion to, you know, cicadas, all sorts of things. It's a wide range.
Hell yeah. Now, I watched 32 Sounds via Screener Link alone in my room. Yep. You know, I was aware that those who were going to be watching it on the 5th of October at VIFF would be watching it with headphones. So I did the same. You know, I wore this headphones to watch the documentary. And I'm glad I did, because the spatial sound completely blew me away. Yeah. It genuinely felt like someone was lighting on matchsticks inside my room, which was weird. Yeah. But then, yeah, definitely watching it via Screener Link alone in my room was definitely an interesting experience, you know?
Yeah.
Even though there was no one around me to peer pressure me into doing the things that the documentary was asking me to do, I still closed my eyes. I still moved my body. And I even shouted at 2 a.m. in the morning, which That's led great. To my very concerned roommate coming into my room being like, what the hell just happened? And then me being like, no, I'm watching art. I'm watching a documentary. You wouldn't get it. But anyway, all of that got me thinking, and that brings me to my next question, which is, what would you say are some of the key differences, you know, some of the things I missed by not watching it live?
Funny, in some ways, I feel like the movie works best in two different ways, in its live form or the way you experienced it at home alone. There's a kind of freedom. And it's interesting because when you're in a movie theater with other people, you're part of a collective. There's a kind of the magic of cinema. You're part of this collective experience, and you go somewhere with other people. It's weird. There are no other avenues of our life or places in our life where we sit next to a stranger and have a profound experience. So there's some magic of that. But then there's also, I think, a real magic of being alone at home with your headphones. You're totally, you know, in a way, you're more alone there than you'll ever be. And that's a powerful place to experience something. So I don't actually think it's a diminished version of what you saw. I think it's a different version, and it traffics in different kind of magic. But, you know, I like both of them. I think they're both good. The fact that you know, at home, you're free in a way. The fact that you could do all that. In a theater, it's sometimes harder to get people to do it because you're around people. But when you wear headphones, you're sort of oddly oblivious to other people. We're all wearing headphones, like nobody can hear me or see me, which is kind of interesting too.
True. No, I mean, great answer. I'm happy to hear I didn't watch an inferior version.
No, not at all.
Which I didn't feel like I did, because I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
But anyway, that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, there's a part of the film where you talk about how tangled up sound and cinema are. And you mentioned sound designer Randy Tom, who said, and I quote, "Sound is a second-class citizen in our consciousness, but it has a secret weapon, stealth. Sound sneaks in the side door of our brains, often completely unnoticed. It works on us as if by magic." And, you know, in that moment where you're talking about Randy Tom and you're sharing this quote, a scene from The Shining is playing in the background. You know, the scene of Danny Torrance in his tricycle speeding through the floors of the Overlook Hotel. And, you know, before we see the scene, the screen is just completely black. You know, we're just listening to the sound. You know, we're listening to the sound of the wheels of the tricycle rolling on the wooden floor, then on the carpet, then on the wooden floor, then on the carpet once again. And when I watched your documentary for the first time, I had no idea what the sound was from. But yet, as soon as I heard it, I instantly felt unease. I instantly felt kind of scared. And then when I saw the image, you know, everything made perfect sense. And I'm like, of course I'm scared. This is The Shining, you know, the movie that freaked me out when I was a child.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that first, I love that moment in your documentary because you undeniably proved the truthfulness of Randy Tom's words. Like, you literally showed me how sound sneakily snuck into my brain and triggered a memory and a feeling without me even knowing, as if by magic.
Also, more than that, I've looked at that scene many times, and I've never understood why it's so unnerving. And there's this weird, for people who don't remember it, and you mentioned it's the kid from The Shining riding through this hotel on a big wheel, and the sound is this interesting thing where he's going over wood, and it's like zzz, and then he's going over carpet, and goes do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and it goes back and forth, and there's nothing on the face of it that should be scary. Yet somehow that sound is profoundly unnerving, and all I can say is it's some weird magic. You know, it really is. So I like that you got it. A lot of times people will say, like, was that your kid or something? You know, and it's like, oh, you missed that. You got to go see The Shining, you know, so.
Definitely. No, I definitely adored it. And that brings me to my next question, which is, what advice would you give to young filmmakers who are tackling sound in their films for the first time?
Ah, wow. Well, it's interesting because, you know, I do documentary film. And one of the things that making this film really drove home to me is the documentary, and I say this lovingly because I love documentary, but documentary is pretty rudimentary in terms of sound. In some ways, it's in the 20th century still. And, you know, you probably know this, you're a young person, but VR and gaming are way ahead of documentary and actually fiction film too in terms of sound. And the reason for that is people wear headphones. And you can do so much with headphones that you can't do with speakers. Binaural sound, ambisonic sound. And so I think documentary and to a lesser extent fiction film is held back by the fact that everybody's making things for a theater, which is basically like maybe stereo or surround sound, but most documentaries are not even surround sound. So it really made me realize in making something that really uses sound in a sophisticated way that, wow, documentary's got a lot of room, a lot of ground to cover to catch up. But if for, I guess for advice, because that was the question you asked, just look at other fields and see how they're using sound and try to incorporate some of that, because people are using sound in amazing ways. You know, there's one of the things I like pointing out is that you can go to the worst piece of shit Hollywood movie and the sound is great. There's no movie you'll see like that where the sound is bad. They're always paying millions of dollars to total pros to do a great sound design and sound mix. So, you know, there's amazing film sound is so incredible. And like you go see like Dune in, you know, Dolby Atmos, that's like being in a mosh pit or something. You know, it's really a profound experience. I did do that myself because Mark Mangini, who's the sound designer for 32 Sounds, did Dune. He actually did Dune right before he did 32 Sounds, which I think shows what a cool guy he is. But he, you know, I boggled my mind that somebody could have in their head that much sound design. You know, like, I imagine him being like, the 27th track on the 45th explosion in the 95th scene was a little loud. You know, like, how do you keep track of that?
That's amazing. Thank you for the advice. Great advice. I'll definitely keep it in mind when I'm, you know, scoring my next short film, I guess. It won't play in theaters, but I'll keep it in mind. Anyway, that brings me to my next question, which is one of my favorite moments in your entire documentary, you know, probably my favorite moment is, you know, the part when you're asking Cheryl Tip, who is the curator of natural science at the British Library Sound Archive, you know, when you ask her for the most striking sound she has ever heard. And, you know, her answer is a recording of the last ever Moho brachatis, which is a now extinct bird that used to live in the islands of Hawaii. You know, a recording of the last ever Moho brachatis calling out to his partner, unaware that his partner was already dead and that he was the last of his species.
Yeah.
First of all, incredible scene. You know, in my letterbox review that I wrote for 32 Sounds, I literally wrote, who would have thought that a blank screen and the mating call of a bird would have come together to create one of the most profound and moving scenes I have ever witnessed. So I was blown away. And that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, I would like to ask you the same question that you asked, question that you asked Cheryl Tip. What is the most striking and arresting sound you have ever heard?
Wow. It's funny because sometimes people will say, like, what's your favorite documentary? And I always feel like I'm failing the test because I never have, like, one favorite, you know, documentary. There's a lot of documentaries I like, and depending on the day, I'll remember this or that one. But it's sort of the same with favorite sound. I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons why one of the main characters in the film is a woman named Anaya Lockwood, who's an old kind of sound artist and musician. And I learned about her when I read in a book a reference to her. It said Anaya Lockwood, who's recorded the sound of rivers for 50 years. And that really intrigued me. I thought to myself, who is this person? Because I love the sound of rivers. I love the sound of water, and I love the sound of rivers especially. And she has made all these records that are sound maps of different rivers. And it sounds like maybe that's dumb. It's just like one recording of the river. But she goes all down the river recording different things, and it's a collage of things. So sometimes, you know, she did the Hudson River, the Danube River, and sometimes it's gurgling, you know, sometimes it's rapids. There's a million different sounds to a river, and all mic'd very close, so it's beautiful sound, and it's just such an incredible, soothing, rich, sonically dense and complex, delightful sound. It's a deeply pleasing sound to me, at least. So that's a great sound. But then there's all sorts of ones, like I love the sound of a dial telephone. You know, that's an old sound. You're too young for that, but older people know that sound from their teenage years. I like the sound of geese, migrating geese, when they fly over and they honk. That sound is a great sound. I could go on and on and on. What sounds do you like?
One. That's a beautiful answer, first of all. Yeah, you know, when I came up with these questions, I was also thinking of myself, you know, what would I say is my favorite sound? Yeah. And I guess I would have to say, you know, back home in Colombia, we have this trees called manglares, which I think the translation in English is mangroves, but it's basically this, you know, beautiful trees with super long roots that grow out of the water, like, you know, right by the beach, you know, right by the sea. And the special thing about manglares and this manglar forest is that, you know, the roots are so intertwined that, like, only little species can go into the trees. So essentially, you know, a bunch of little species and little animals and, you know, little bugs and fish go into the manglares in order to hatch their babies.
Yeah.
So these manglares essentially become like nursery homes for sea life and ocean life. So, you know, whenever me and my family, whenever we go to the Caribbean Sea and we go to one of these manglar rainforests, it's always a special experience to, you know, submerge my head.
A lot of sound?
Oh, it sounds like everything and nothing at the same time. It sounds like eclosions and weird little popping noises and like gurgling and screaming. And it's you know, I remember when I was very young, I went there with my grandma and I asked her, what is that? Like, I went under what? I was like, what the hell am I listening to? And I think she said, life, you know, very, very poetic, wise grandma thing to say.
But
It has stuck with me, and I think to this day...
I'm going to go online and look. I'll see if I can find something about that.
I hope you can, and if you can't, you know, this December when I go back, I'll try to make a recording, and I'll send it to you somehow.
Cool.
But anyway, I think we've already talked about what my next question is going to be, but, you know, just in case, throughout the film, you also place particular importance on the relationship between sound and memory, you know, the fact that sound that you hear in the present can instantly trigger a memory of something that happened in the past. So my question is, excluding music, what is a sound that is particularly nostalgic to you? You know, a sound that instantly evokes a strong memory from your past.
Well, it said the dial telephone, but there's also there are a lot of sounds I tried to work into 32 sounds that just for one reason or another didn't work. And one of them was a series of extinct sounds. And so it was the dial telephone, the fax machine, and the dial-up modem. All of these are things that, like, if you're a certain age, you remember fax machines made a specific noise. And all those are deeply Another one is the end of a record player, when it the record gets the end and it kind of makes this funny repeating sound. So that's then there's, well, music, you said no music. Snow, I grew up in Michigan, and snow, like the kind of, it's in the film, the sound of snow falling, and that sound, it's almost like a sonic environment. It's more like a feeling, actually, when there's a big snow at night, everything is still and quiet in this way that it never is in the summer. You know, in the summer, there's insects and birds, and but also the snow muffles sound, so everything is very quiet. There's a kind of quiet that comes with snow that really brings me back. Also, I grew up in a college town. Now you're really getting me going. I grew up in a college town, and on Saturday mornings, there would be football games at the stadium, which is maybe like 2 miles from my house. But I would hear like the wafting of like a marching band, and also like an announcer over loudspeakers. You know, you couldn't hear the words, but you could hear like, you know, just sort of this hint of a loudspeaker and sometimes a marching band. And it just like, oh, it's fall and the college football game's happening. So I'm sure everybody has similar things that even telling it, you can see my face kind of changes. I feel, you know, memory is, sound and memory is so weird. You don't even need the sound. You just remember the sound and then it brings it all back.
You definitely paint a beautiful picture. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
But okay, I guess moving on.
Yeah.
The next thing I will say is, you know, in my opinion, one of the most fascinating ideas that are tackled throughout 32 Sounds is the idea of sound as a way to stop death, you know, a way to keep people alive. Throughout the film, you allude to some old tapes that you own, and these tapes, which you refer to as old ghosts, contain voice recordings of people that were once close to you but who now are dead.
Yeah.
At first, you refused to listen to the tapes because you feared that you would get used to them and that the magical thing where the tape actually holds a person would wear off. Then that said, you know, eventually you realize in the documentary that, you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's letting go.
Yeah.
And then the screen fades to black as we listen to these recordings. Now, I assume that for those experiencing the documentary live, you know, their focus would shift to you. As soon as the screen goes black, you know, they would start watching you intently as they try to decipher if you have indeed let go, you know, if you're no longer affected by the tapes.
That's one.
Am I right?
Well, that's one place that's a little different in the live version. In the live version, I actually leave and just let the thing play, and I'm not there.
I love that. I love that. Oh, it's like the spinning top at the end of Inception. Make them guess. Hell yeah. Oh, I love that ambiguity. Hell yeah. Okay, I you know, I had a whole subsequent question, you know, regarding how you answered this one, but I feel like let's keep it ambiguous. Let's not keep digging. And I respect that a lot. Hell yeah. Okay, now I guess the last thing I'll say is, you know, in regards to this last question that I asked is, I do have something to confess, and that is, you know, I have to thank you for, because, you know, this film, 32 Sounds, inspired me to do something similar to what you did in this part of the movie. You know, years ago, my grandfather from my father's side was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia. And growing up throughout my life, I always heard about, you know, the great stories of Alvaro Sá, you know, the great stories of my grandfather about, you know, his fishing trips and how he built our farm and how he fell in love with my grandma and, you know, even stories of his kidnapping back in the 90s.
Wow.
And then, you know, I had always heard bits and pieces, but I had never like sat down to hear the entire thing. And then during the pandemic, you know, we were all forced, my whole family, I flew back to Colombia and we were all just like staying together in the farm with my grandfather. And back then, you know, his Alzheimer's and his dementia, it weren't that bad. You know, it was still, you know, pretty mild. So, you know, I figured there's, you know, there's not a better time than this. So I finally sat down with him and I recorded a conversation where I asked him about, you know, as many of the stories as I could. And ever since that day, back in 2020, I never listened to that recording. It has stayed in my computer.
Yeah.
You know, in a little file hidden, but I never listened to it. And then I finally listened to it after watching 32 Sounds. I felt inspired by your actions, and I did. And so thank you for that. It really means a lot.
Make sure you back that file up too. Put it in a couple places. You don't want to lose it. That's like a very valuable thing. Good job in doing that. I mean, at a certain point, it'll be too late. All those stories will be gone in a way. So you'll be happy in 20 years you have that.
Yeah. It was definitely interesting to you know, listen to his voice once again. Oh, I forgot to mention, but yeah, he passed away this summer. So
oh, I didn't know that. Okay, that makes it even more poignant.
It was a cool experience, and I'm glad I did. So thank you. Good. Your documentary really, really touched me. Now I guess my next question is,
yep.
You know, at the end of the credits, there is a note that states that your live documentary, 32 Sounds, was inspired by a biopic directed by Francois Girard called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, which was in turn inspired by a musical piece composed by Johann Sebastian Bach called The Goldberg Variations.
Yep.
First of all, that is fascinating. Uh-huh. Second of all, my question is, what would you say is the through line that connects all three of this art pieces? You know, what do they have in common and what brings them together?
I was most inspired by 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, which is a movie about the Canadian pianist, and it's a biopic you mentioned, but to me, biopics are my least favorite genre. I can't stand them because they're so formulaic. You know, it's always like, starts with the scene, then flashes back to the person's life, then ends up back at this scene, you know, Johnny Cage, Johnny Cash, you know, that was a great movie, and I like Joaquin Phoenix, but it just, the form is so tired, I think. And also, like, no lives, all of our lives are way too messy and complicated to fit into a three-act structure and its sort of narrative arc. So I love 32 Short Films of Glenn Gould. It's one of my favorite films because it's a portrait of the pianist in just bits and pieces, and it's different scenes. It's a Canadian documentary, different scenes. Some of them are animation, some are actors, some are documentary, and it's just delightful. You never know where it's going, but it, you know, it's a profound movie. So I thought, when I'm making a movie about sound, I can't make the movie about sound. You know, I'm just going to make a subjective thing, you know, my feelings about sound, my thoughts, and all I can do is bits and pieces. So I like that as a form and an approach. And I also like that 32 was taken from this, you mentioned Goldberg Variations, which is Glenn Gould's signature work. And so it's not so much the Goldberg Variations themselves, but just the idea that art can reverberate through the ages. And that inspired Glenn Gould, that inspired the movie, that inspired me. And hopefully, you know, the reverberations will continue on. I like that idea because nobody thinks of anything, you know, from total scratch. You're in dialogue with other people and other artists and the things you've seen and the things that have been, like, acknowledging that and being part of that.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. This
thank
was truly
you very
amazing.
Much. Are you going to come on to see the show?
I really want to, and I wish I could, but unfortunately, I'm also working as a venue manager at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival, so I'm afraid I will be working on the 5th of October.
All right. Well,
but I will be thinking.
You, that would be great because I like what you do and I appreciate the time and the conversation.
And welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that interview. That was, once again, an interview with the one and only Sam Green, documentarian filmmaker who recently made a live documentary called 32 Sounds. I loved talking to Sam. I mean, I guess you can hear from that interview, but I had a lot of fun. I had a blast. What an insightful, smart, creative person. The way he talks, the way he articulates his thoughts and just, you know, talks about his craft, talks about sound. He talks with so much passion and so much humanity that, you know, this was definitely one of the highlights of the festival for me. Interviewing Sam was absolutely amazing. And I am a bit bummed that I wasn't able to check out 32 Sounds live on the 5th of October. But, you know, watching it on my own in my room was still a pretty amazing experience. But, okay, anyway, that was it for my interview with Sam Green. Now, moving on with my coverage of the 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival, I guess it's time I review one of the movies that I saw at this year's VIFF. So, one of the big films that came this year was Priscilla, which Priscilla, for those of you who don't know, is the newest movie directed by Sofia Coppola, you know, the director of Lost in Translation, the director of Marie Antoinette, the director of The Virgin Suicides. And, you know, Sofia Coppola, of course, she's also the daughter of the one and only Francis Ford Coppola, the director of the Godfather films, Apocalypse Now, The Conversation, Bram Stoker's Dracula, a lot more. But yeah, so I watched Priscilla at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. I saw it on the 7th of October, and now I am going to play my review of Priscilla. That said, before I play my review and I give you all my thoughts of what I thought about the film, before, I think it is time we go to a little musical break and we listen to a song that is closely related to Priscilla. So, even though the Priscilla movie doesn't feature any music from Elvis Presley, because the Elvis estate didn't allow them to use any of the songs, I did find out by doing a little research online that apparently one of Priscilla Presley's favorite Elvis Presley songs is the song Love Me Tender, which apparently Elvis performed at in the Ed Sullivan Show in 1956. So, before I give you my review of Priscilla, we will first go to a little musical break. I will play some ads, some PSAs, and then I will play the song Love Me Tendered by Elvis Presley. And then, right after that, you'll hear my thoughts on Priscilla. Without further ado, here is the little ad break, and here we go.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
Anthasiaklia, Talitin, Homusqueam, Mustail. Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Discover Noreen Braun's album Songs for Trees, dedicated to the forests and the spirits within the trees. As we fight climate change, trees are the lungs of the planet and we need to help them. Her jazz and blues are blended with rock and synthesized pop elements to create a textured and ambient soundtrack to nature. Songs for Trees is a narrative, with each song guiding us through a journey through the forest. A trip, literally and metaphorically, about the interconnectedness of all things. The Vancouver Sun names it one of five albums you need to hear. Find out more at noreenbraun.com.
Elvis is going to sing for you the theme song of his new 20th Century Fox picture, and later in the evening I want you to meet Robert Webb, who directed it. Now, the song, as he does it in the picture, Love Me Tender, is when his three brothers have come home from the Confederate armies. He's the younger brother who's been left back home, and he sings this song to his mother and his young bride. This is Love Me Tender.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Palosa, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that musical break. That was, once again, Love Me Tender, performed by the one and only Elvis Presley at the Ed Sullivan Show in October 28th of 1956. And the reason why I'm playing this song is because Love Me Tender, according to some research I did, Love Me Tender was one of Priscilla Presley's favorite songs from her then-husband, Elvis Presley. Now, and the reason why I'm playing this and the reason why I'm mentioning this is because now I'm about to play my review of Priscilla, the newest film from Sofia Coppola. Priscilla, which I watched at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival on the 7th of October. And here is my review. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. Okay, it's been a while since I've done this, and, you know, I've been thinking, what should be the movie that brings me back? What should be the first movie that I review when I come back to Take One? And then I realized, you know, the first movie I ever reviewed for the show was Elvis, directed by Baz Luhrmann, which tells the story of the one and only Elvis Presley. So I figured, what better way to come back than by reviewing Priscilla, which tells the story of Priscilla Presley, the wife of Elvis Presley. So, without further ado, here is my review of Priscilla. Priscilla was directed by Sofia Coppola, who directed some great films such as The Virgin Suicides, Marie Antoinette, and my personal favorite of hers is Lost in Translation. Absolutely beautiful movie. I would highly recommend you all to watch it if you haven't already. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who don't know, Sofia Coppola is also, of course, the daughter of the one and only Francis Ford Coppola, the director of the Godfather movies, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, you know, that's where the last name comes from. But the point is, her most recent film is Priscilla, and I think this movie is good enough, but it is very much a mixed bag. There are many things that I very much enjoy, but there are also many things that didn't quite work for me. I guess I'll begin by talking about the lead performance from Kaylee Spaney. Yeah, that is her name. That performance was absolutely incredible. She nailed it when trying to be Priscilla. She really became Priscilla. The subtlety of her emotions and the subtlety of her performance was something that really shined through and is something that I would really like to highlight. You know, she won Best Actress at the Venice Film Festival, and I think there's a good reason why. She was absolutely amazing. And this is not a showy performance. There's not a lot of showy, big explosions of emotions. It is very subtle. It is very under the surface, but yet it is still there. Now, the next two things that I really freaking enjoyed about the movie are the production design and the costume design. I thought the production design was absolutely amazing. The sets were incredible. They look colorful, beautiful, pretty, lavish, opulent. You know, very much what, you know, the settings would have been like in real life. I'm not really sure if they shot this movie in Graceland, the home of, you know, Elvis and Priscilla Presley, or if they recreated Graceland, but either way, they did a great job of bringing Graceland to life. So the sets, absolutely incredible. And the costumes, just as incredible. The way this film recreates some of the most iconic costumes from Priscilla Presley was honestly breathtaking and incredibly well made. So, you know, kudos to those department, you nailed it. Now, something else that I would like to highlight, and I think is what I love the most about this movie, is the sense of claustrophobia and the feeling of claustrophobia that this movie gives you. Because, you know, for those of you who don't know, this movie, Priscilla, focuses on Priscilla as being trapped in this gilded cage. Yes, her cage is made out of gold and she has all the money she could ever want, but it is still a cage nonetheless. She feels trapped, she feels like she can't have a normal life because she is married to Elvis Presley and, you know, that comes with some expectations, I guess, or some things that she is forced to do. So she very much feels trapped, and I feel like this movie did a great job at making us, the viewers, feel equally as trapped and equally as claustrophobic as the main character. The cinematography is very claustrophobic. There are a lot of close-ups. We are always very close to Priscilla. But also, you know, the way the film is structured, there are huge chunks of the movie where we don't leave Graceland. The camera is literally trapped inside these four walls along with Priscilla. So that sense of claustrophobia, I thought, was beautifully conveyed and I thought was just very, very well made. That said, those were the positives. Sadly, there are other things that didn't quite work for me in this movie. And I guess the first thing I will say is the performance from Jacob Elordi as Elvis Presley. And I will start by saying that I know, it's not his fault. I can see that he's doing his best and I can see that he's really trying, but you know, it is not his fault that he is acting as Elvis Presley the year after Austin Butler gave us the definitive Elvis Presley performance in Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. You know, when I was watching the movie, it always felt like, oh, this is Jacob Elordi pretending to be Elvis Presley. But when I watched Austin Butler once again, it felt like this is not Austin Butler pretending to be Elvis Presley. This is Elvis Presley. He became Elvis Presley somehow. So once again, not his fault, but you know, it is what it is. He acted as Elvis Presley the year after Austin Butler, and in my opinion, he didn't do as good of a job. Now, the next things that didn't quite work for me, and I would say the biggest thing that didn't quite work for me, was the script. The script for Priscilla, I'm sad to say this, but the script for Priscilla is an absolute mess. It is incredibly messy, and I think what worked the least for me was the structure. The structure of Priscilla is all over the place and not in a good way. The best way I could explain it is the film takes a long period of time. You know, we spend a long period of time focusing on the courting of Priscilla Presley and, you know, how Elvis and Priscilla became a thing. And then it also spends a long period of time on the first couple of months of Priscilla living in Graceland. So all of that is like the biggest chunk of the movie. You know, this is a 1 hour, 50 minute film. And I would say that like an hour and 10, an hour and 20 minutes are all focused on that. Elvis and Priscilla becoming a couple, and the first couple of months of Priscilla living in Graceland. But then, you know, after that, after those chunks have been explored, it honestly feels like Sofia Coppola realized, oh my god, we only have 30 more minutes left of the movie, and we still have all of this story from Priscilla Presley's life that we still haven't tackled. So then she just started rushing, and, you know, towards the end, it felt like it was a non-stop montage showing you bit after bit, anecdote after anecdote of Priscilla Presley's life. And it just felt incredibly disjointed, especially when compared to, you know, the first hour and 10 minutes of the movie. In the last 30 minutes, the film very quickly rushes you through Priscilla and Elvis getting married, Priscilla getting pregnant, they have a baby, Elvis cheats on Priscilla, Priscilla stays alone, she wants to leave, they fight, and it's so fast-paced, and it is, you know, so rushed. I guess that is the right way to say it. It feels rushed. And I know what you're probably thinking. The Elvis movie that came out last year from Baz Luhrmann, that movie was incredibly hectic and was incredibly rushed. You know, we could barely stay in any specific moment because we were instantly jumping from one scene to the next one, from past to the future, from present to the past. It was hectic. It was energetic. There was barely any time to breathe. But I think what bothers me here in Priscilla that didn't bother me in Elvis is, at least in Elvis, that was the entirety of the movie. The entire film was hectic. The entire film was frenetic. That was very much its style. But here in Priscilla, you have 1 hour and 10 minutes or 1 hour and 20 minutes that are very methodical, very conventionally paced. And then out of nowhere, the last 30 minutes are just like this nonstop rush where, yeah, once again, it feels like Sofia Coppola is rushing to cram as much movie into this, you know, to cram as much story into this movie as possible. Now, something else that didn't work for me about the script is, you know, sadly, many of the scenes ended up feeling repetitive or pointless, in my opinion. This movie, for those of you who don't know, is based on a book written by Priscilla Presley, a book called Elvis and Me, or Elvis and I, something like that, written by Priscilla Presley. And when I was watching this movie, I guess the best way I could explain it is, when I was watching this film, I never felt like Sofia Coppola had, like, okay, yes, this is what we're building up to. This is my thesis statement. This is what I'm trying to say with this film. And then all of these are scenes that help me reach that point, you know, that help me convey that message. It never felt like that. It didn't really feel like the movie was building up to anything. It just felt like, honestly, it felt like Sofia Coppola just read the book and she was like handpicking this chapter, this anecdote, and this anecdote, not because they helped her make her point, but because she just found those interesting. And they are good anecdotes, but they end up becoming repetitive, you know? After a while, you kind of feel like one scene after the other are saying pretty much the same thing in a slightly different way. So yeah, by far, my biggest problem with Priscilla is the script. The structure is an absolute mess, and many of the scenes, in my opinion, feel repetitive and pointless. Now, there is one last problem that I have with Priscilla. There is, you know, there is one last thing that I have to highlight, because honestly, it sticks out like a sore thumb, and that is the music, or I guess I should say the lack thereof. Because yes, this movie, Priscilla, about Priscilla Presley, doesn't feature a single Elvis Presley song. And, you know, that could be an interesting thing to do, you know, telling the story of Priscilla Presley, but not showing any of Elvis's music, you know, like reframing the story, focusing on Priscilla, Elvis doesn't really matter. That could have been interesting. That said, a lot of this movie is focused on how Priscilla can't avoid Elvis Presley. The fact that, regardless how hard she tries in certain scenes, she just can't escape the influence of Elvis Presley. She sees him on TV, she sees him on newspapers, she sees him in the covers of magazines, she hears his music on the radio. You know, Elvis is everywhere. She can't escape him. That said, the fact that there's not a single song from Elvis Presley doesn't really help drive that point. Now, I understand that this is not the movie's fault. I understand that the Elvis estate, you know, the Presley estate, apparently they didn't allow this movie to feature any of Elvis Presley's songs. I do think that is something that stuck out like a sore thumb through the entirety of the movie, especially if you're making such a big deal about highlighting how Priscilla cannot escape Elvis, how Elvis is everywhere. but yet there's not a single Elvis song. I don't know. Felt a bit weird to me. I guess in a thumbs up, thumbs down world, I would give Priscilla a thumbs up. I think there is just enough stuff for me to say that this movie is fine. It is enjoyable enough. Once again, the lead performance is incredible. The set design is amazing. The production design is gorgeous. The costumes are absolutely incredible. And then also, once again, that sense of claustrophobia is something that is not easy to do, and this movie pulled off very, very expertly. So there is just enough good stuff for me to say this film is fine, for me to say this film is good enough. That said, it is very much a mixed bag. Considering that, if I were to give a score to Priscilla, I would give it a 6 out of 10, which means I think this movie is fine. It's good enough. But yeah, that has been my review of Priscilla. Stay tuned for more reviews. Goodbye. Hello, hello. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that review of, once again, that was a review of Priscilla, the newest film from Sofia Coppola about the story of Priscilla Presley, the wife of Elvis Presley. Yeah, that was my review, and that brings our episode to an end. You know, we had an interview with Sam Green. If you missed it, definitely go to the CITR website and listen to the whole episode so that you can catch that interview. It is an interview that I am very proud of. And then after the interview with Sam Green, we had my review of Priscilla. Once again, that brings the episode to an end. So that has been it. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Once again, keep tuning in every Thursday. Today's Tuesday. Oh my God. Keep tuning in every Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m. if you want to keep listening to Take One and if you want to keep hearing more movie reviews and more interviews. Next week, I have a third very special interview for all of you guys, plus a review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest film, The Boy and the Heron, which I was also able to watch at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. So once again, stay tuned. Come back every Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m. But that has been it for this episode of Take One. And now, before we leave, let's go to a short little ad break. And here we go.
Old growth forests matter. Join us in supporting the Arasque's Fairy Creek Blockade. Indigenous communities have been on the front lines of the logging disasters in BC. And we are calling on all land defenders to help us save the last of Canada's old growth forests. You can donate online through the Climate Justice UBC Instagram page and through QR codes on flyers that have been posted throughout campus. For donations of sleeping bags, blankets, and clothing, there will be collection bins at Sprouts Cafe, located in the basement of the Life Building, and at the Center for Interactive Research on Sustainability, located at 2260 West Mall. Donation pickups will happen on October 30th, November 13th, and November 27th. For more information, go to Climate Justice UBC on Instagram.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.